This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 129. Today is our Christ and Culture Roundup. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and we are back. We are live. We have finished our Christ and Culture discussion, but as you're going to find out, we haven't had quite enough of it. And to join me today to speak about a roundup of our entire series here is Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jeff.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be back and to be live.
Yes, absolutely. We have, it's been a while for us. We haven't been speaking together for a little bit because we've been doing our Christ and Culture series, but finally we are back and we are ready to roll with a discussion on the subject.
So it's been a while since we've had a live episode of CTC.
Yeah, and I think it was well worthwhile. We got some lessons to learn. You know, because I think it ended up going a little bit long to have it all in one lump. So maybe next time, if we do another series on another topic, we'll split it up and intersperse some other episodes in between the different rounds.
We do that at in the preaching at Calvary and Ringgoes. Jim, of course, is the primary preacher. I only preach occasionally, but yeah. He will take it. For instance, this past Sunday night, he just completed book two of the Psalter, and then he's going to pick up with a series on First Chronicles, and then he will return at some point to book three. And so we found that that's probably a good thing to do. And it's funny. And so Ian Campbell has a post over at Reformation 21 where he argues in favor of not Lectio Continua.
Well, I think Lectio Continua is good, but giving a break.
I do too.
And I think it's just good psychology too. I mean, many scientists have done studies on the learning process and found that, you know, taking naps or taking breaks actually helps your brain process and
amen, brother. I've made a habit of taking naps.
Yeah, anyway, sometimes we take too many naps in between our studies, but overall, it's good to put a break. So we've got several ideas for future discussions and debates, perhaps on the days of creation, perhaps on apologetic methodology. There's all sorts of opportunities for discussion within the Reformed community, but we thought a big discussion on Christ and culture would be a good way to just start up some cogs in people's minds to think about some of these subjects, because they're difficult, trying to understand how the church and how a Christian should relate to the culture in all sorts of different venues, how we should understand God's law, how we should understand revelation, all of these sorts of things. It's important for the Christian to have some idea of how this stuff works out.
Well, I agree. And of course, this discussion is timely because it is the issue being debated in the broader Reformed community outside of Christ the Center.
Yeah, so absolutely.
It made good sense to deal with it. And one thing I guess I was going to say before we delve into details is that, and you maybe have found yourself the same way, is that there's no one of the four speakers where I completely agreed, and there's none of the four speakers that I completely disagreed with.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix, and I think we'll have an interesting discussion today as we get into that. We have had some specific requests to do kind of a roundup episode because of such the long and the large nature of our of our project. It's Jeff and I are just going to try to round up the discussion and maybe give our own opinion on some of the subject. But before we do that, I'd like to start somewhat of a new segment in Christ the Center. And around the seminary and in the theological world, sometimes we develop little theological problems for our little brains to think through. So I want to start a new segment. Maybe we'll continue this. If it doesn't go over well, maybe we won't. But we'll call it the Theological Puzzle of the Week. I need a drum roll or something, but I don't have the sound effects. I don't have the soundboard like we do for Philosophy for Theologians, and I'm sure many of the listeners out there are glad that I don't have a soundboard. If you've ever heard that program, it's for a certain audience.
It must be for me, because I really enjoy. I was listening to the Metaphysics of Aristotle, and I really enjoyed that Jonathan Brack.
Yeah, and you know, I forget who it was, but it might have been Calvin, it might have been Thomas. I can't place the theologian, but he had some funny comment about stupid questions or silly questions that his students would bring to him, and he'd said they'd be better off doing something else. I forget the exact quote. But,
well, I know it was it was Augustine or somebody who said. What was hell created for?
Yeah. Theological students who come to him with these funny questions.
Right.
Well, anyway, I'm one of those students, and I'm sure I pester many of my professors with silly questions. But I want to present one just to, you know, to help us think through an issue, regardless of if it might be humorous or if you think, why in the world are we even talking about this? Okay, let's start this. Well, Jeff, what is your position of the second commandment? How does that work itself out? Terms of images of God,
yeah.
Images of Christ. What do you personally think about
that? It's interesting you should ask. That's something where I think I can track my own pilgrimage, because I didn't grow up in the Reformed community. The idea that the second commandment, which is about not making graven images, right?
Yeah.
It never occurred to me that pictures of Jesus would be breaking of the second commandment. And you know, maybe I should say at the beginning that in light of that, it might be good for the Reformed community to not assume that it's obvious to everybody else.
Well, there are many Reformed people that have thought through the issue and don't think it's a violation.
That's
so
true.
So I want to leave some charity here, but I'm just asking you personally what you think about pictures or images of Christ or God or anything.
Let's start with the idea that I haven't torn off all the pictures of Jesus on my books where there are pictures of Jesus. Okay. I don't do that.
Commit them to the flames.
Right. No, I don't do that. Yeah. I do think that the second commandment, which of course is related to the regulative principle as well.
Yes, very much so.
And that's that's actually in the background, isn't it, of the Reformed understanding of image. You cannot image, and even you can't even image the Son of God in his incarnate state. And that's probably the debatable issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the rule is we are not to create images of God because he commands us not to do it,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's correct.
That's the second commandment. It is extended to the incarnation, and this is where you would have trouble, because many people, like I thought, that the incarnation is the very illustration, pardon the pun, of how that doesn't apply. It's the exception, I should say, the grand exception to applying the second commandment, because the fact that God himself decided that he would embody, you know, take upon himself, the second person of the Trinity would take upon himself a human nature. Now, of course, if you look at the Reformed prohibition on images, you'll see that and if you look at the second commandment, it's that God determines how he will reveal himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the problem with pictures of Jesus, on a secondary note, is of course we don't know what he looked like.
Right. Now, some people will say, "Okay, there are different views." Some people will say no images at all. I'm one of those. Others will say no images in the worship service. And the thing that they will appeal to is that you're also not allowed to make images of birds and fish and all these sorts of things. And then there's a phrase connected to the commandment that you're not supposed to bow down and worship these images.
Right.
Now, I hear that. I hear that that argument to say that you're right. The specific commandment is not to make a graven image to worship it. Now, but how I arrive at the fact that I am opposed to any image of Christ, of God, even of the Spirit, is to say that, well, then I see that as a violation of the third commandment, is if we are to worship the Lord and we are supposed to take his name with reverence and awe, and we're always supposed to think about him respectfully and worshipfully. If we were to see an image of Jesus or of God, of the Spirit, the Father, and not worship it. In my understanding of the third commandment, that would be a violation of, right. of the third commandment. So any now, image of God, in my estimation, would either be a violation of the second, either you're bowing down and worshiping an image, or the third, either you're contemplating God without worshiping him.
Now, let me ask you this question, mm-hmm. though. God, the Holy Spirit came in the form of a dove, and that's biblical.
That's another, is a picture of a dove specifically used to reference the Spirit. Is that, would that be a violation of the, that's one of the puzzles I have.
Yeah, I have a problem because it's biblical, you see. The other thing happens to be that the Lord did command in the building of the tabernacle and the temple, of angels. So right. that's where it puts the brakes on things, or at least we have to nuance what we say.
Right.
But still, I think we can all agree that the second commandment does say something to this issue,
mm-hmm.
Even if we come down a little differently on the specifics of how, you know, what we think it says. It certainly says we ought to slow down.
Right.
I actually don't believe in pictures of Jesus,
right?
Or other, you know, types of symbols. I'm not going to be looking to stamp the. I'm not an iconoclast. Maybe that's what I'm. What I would be.
Nor
saying.
Are you an iconographer? But now let me get to the actual puzzle. This is where you'll see the silly theological part. What about translations of the Bible into a language such as Egyptian hieroglyphics?
Well, there you've got a problem. Well, actually, you don't have to go that. You can go with Chinese and Japanese and Korean because those are based on,
pictographical.
The alphabet involves pictures.
But specifically, we could think of an old version of hieroglyphics in which the older version, which you have a character you would... In order to you have the word God or Jesus represented in the language, you would have to necessarily have a picture of him to represent. So my question, my puzzle of the week is, for someone like me with a Reformed conviction that the Second Commandment forbids all images of God, whether that's the danger of breaking the Second or the Third Commandment if you encounter an image of God, does that forbid a translation into a pictographical language system?
Well, our standards don't go that way because they call us to translate the Bible into all the languages of the people.
Right.
And there's no footnote saying with the exception of that's actually it's humorous, but on the other hand, it's actually
you get into semiotics and the philosophy of symbols and language. And
now let me ask you a related question, because that's a question that you've raised that I don't think we can settle here now. I have a friend who says that the second and third commandments prevent him from imagining when he reads the Gospels, the disciples and our Lord.
Right.
I have a problem. He says he can read the accounts without imagining the story.
Yeah, it's hard to understand how you could read and meditate on Scripture without some sort of contemplation in your mind.
I find that artificial myself.
Yeah.
And so that also enters into this question.
Certainly, which lends for the view that images not... You know, certain types of mental images would be permissible, that sort of thing. So that's all. I didn't mean to dive in completely deeply, but I just wanted to set up the little puzzle and, send us your thoughts.
That is a good one. That's a good one.
And mail at reformedforum.org. You can find our Facebook group at facebook.com/reformedforum. I have certain thoughts about how to get around that supposed problem, because I think it would certainly be permissible to have the Bible translated in hieroglyphics. But how we get there is an interesting subject. So,
right.
To put an end to the puzzle of the week, we will now move on to today's discussion. On Christ and Culture, one last time, we're going to do a roundup episode on the entire series. Not going to go into too much detail on each individual speaker, But just what were your general thoughts, Jeff? You already mentioned a little bit on how you agreed and disagreed.
Yeah, I was going to say I have a subtitle for this episode.
Okay.
Beating a dead horse.
Beating a dead horse, okay.
No.
That's fair.
Actually, why don't we go by subject or topic?
Yes, we'll start here with...
That would be helpful for me, because there were so many different things that were discussed in the series.
Of course, our participants were Daryl Hart, Bill Dennison, Nelson Klosterman, and Doug Wilson. Right. And all coming from different perspectives. At times, it seemed as though Daryl Hart and Bill Dennison agreed more, they had more affinity with each other. And Klosterman and Wilson had more affinity with each other. But that didn't always hold true in every single subject.
Right, and that's getting at what I said earlier about none of the four did I find myself in complete agreement with
all
the time. And that may relate, that may just reveal the richness of the Reformed faith or the confusion. But,
or the confusion, yeah. Well, our first subject under our project was that of politics. And the first question I asked was, what is the applicability of the Mosaic Law to the church now? Or not only to the church, but to the culture. How do we apply the Mosaic Law? Now, the relation of the Mosaic Law to the culture and even to the Christian church has been much debated, not only in the Reformed community, but in all of Christendom and Christianity. Right. People have had all sorts of different ways of answering that question. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, because I'm an officer in the OPC, and I take my vows seriously, I believe that the Mosaic Law can be appropriately divided into the ceremonial, the moral, and the judicial.
I don't think any of the participants disagreed with that.
Right, no. Right. I mean, that's a division that goes back at least to Thomas Aquinas, if not before that.
Yeah.
And I think if we recognize that no Jew in the Old Testament would have divided the law in that way, in the sense of, we can parcel out different parts, because they would have said that all of these things interpenetrate and cohere.
Sure.
And we actually grant that point. The tripartite distinction is a helpful tool.
Right. But it's difficult in certain portions,
and it also,
to decide which is which.
It only arises because of the coming of Christ, right?
Hmm.
I mean, so to say that no Old Testament Jew would have done this is almost beside the point, right? Hmm. Because we're saying that we're Christians and we come after Christ, and therefore we have to reckon with this issue. Hmm. My answer is that with the Westminster Standards, the civic and the judicial and the ceremonial law have passed away, and that the moral law abides.
That's because Israel was a particular theocratic nation existing for a particular purpose. It having passed away as a theocratic nation, the laws that were designed to govern that theocratic nation have now ceased to be important. However, the moral law is something abiding, something that reflects and is something of God's own character, which is always applicable for everyone, everywhere, for all times.
Correct. Now, with the standards, I would say that we still benefit from looking at the Old Testament ceremonial and judicial law. For the ceremonial law, of course, especially because it points us to Christ's sacrificial death on the cross, right?
But even the civic, there's much wisdom. Portress has written much on, he has a nice section and even a critique of our current current prison system.
Yes, in The Shadow of Christ and the Law of Moses.
Yeah, the book The Shadow of Christ and the Law of Moses, in which he derives and tries to work with the wisdom found in how Israelites punished their crimes.
And that's why, of course, this is a complex question, because on the one hand, we're saying we can't apply the Mosaic Law in exactly the same way that the Old Testament Jews would have, for the various reasons we've just discussed, but it's still applicable in some sense, right? It's applicable to us in the sense that there's wisdom to be gained, equity, right? That's the language that's used.
There's a redemptive historical contour to all of this.
Yes,
and as we would say, for instance, in any biblical account of one of the patriarchs or a biblical character, there can be much that we can learn about a person and how God dealt with that person and the circumstances of their life. But we at the same time don't take a wooden like exemplary view when we preach them either. We don't say that, right. you know, just because, you know, David committed adultery with Bathsheba, their firstborn son was killed, that's going to happen to you. You know, look at David. He was an example. God doesn't work that way. There's a redemptive historical contour, and there are specifics Correct. In situations that we need to take account right. of.
Now, you might find it interesting that, if I remember correctly, in the founding of America, with the Puritans and the Pilgrims, this was an issue of dispute. You had members of the
right the Puritan canopy,
right, right? You had members within the camp who debated over whether the new laws that they would establish, say in the Plymouth colony, the Plymouth yeah. plantation, whether they had to be they had to directly build upon the Mosaic law or merely reflect the equity of the Mosaic law.
That's a good
Now remember, this is 20 some years before the Westminster Assembly.
Right.
Okay. But this very debate was carried on. You had men who said, no, our laws, in order to be blessed by God, and that's a whole other issue, right, must be directly taken from the Mosaic administration. And then right. you had others that said, no, that those laws were, in terms of their minute detail, are limited to that particular a stage of redemptive history. Mm. So this has been an ongoing debate in our circles for 400 and some years.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's nothing new.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that I would say is that we need to recognize that Israel was not merely one nation among many. Mm. As I understand it, the theonomic view is that Israel was more like the nations of the world than unlike them. And that's how they can say, or that's a plank in their argument for the abiding validity of the Mosaic law in all of its detail.
Mm.
At least I could be wrong, but I think, and this is where someone like Meredith Klein would go up against that and say, no, Israel is a theocratic state, very different. Of course, there are similarities, there are human beings involved, but a very different kind of nation state, in this instance, both a church and a state mixed together, right? We don't have that. We are not. Now we could get into the whole issue of America as a Christian nation. We are not Israel.
No.
Period.
Right.
Now that's not to answer the question. Well, how as Christians do we live in a constitutional republic like we have in the U.S.? That's a whole related to but different set of questions.
Well, let me ask you then: what is the role of the civil government?
Yeah, I figured you'd ask that question.
Well, for me, it is twofold. It's to restrain evil and to uphold or promote justice.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
That can be interpreted several different ways, but I agree with Klein. I think the civil government was established in Genesis 4 after Cain was exiled from the garden, thrown out from his people and had to go wander in the wilderness. He complains and he's very afraid to go out there because he's certain that there's lawlessness out there and someone's right. going to kill him. And I agree with Klein. I agree with his take that God at that point instituted civil governments to take care of that and to restrain evil and try to promote justice in some way.
That's an interesting question. A few years back, I took a course on the history of Christian ethics at Temple University, and I wrote a paper on whether government was a result of the fall or just a matter of part of creation. And I looked at Augustine and I looked at Aquinas, and believe it or not, I got help from Herman Dooyeweerd. don't say that too loud. No, I shouldn't say, but as I looked, Aquinas, following Aristotle, understood that human beings were social by nature. So he saw government as not being the result of the fall, but being the result merely of a humans being social creature.
Yeah.
Augustine, on the other hand, if I remember correctly, argued that government was the result of the fall.
I think what a lot of I agree with Augustine. I think what many people would see as the role of government in a good sense, not simply the restraining evil, but the promoting justice or the ordering, the structure. I think without sin, either God just does it himself or there's no need of it, or the family could do it. I mean, I just struggle with trying to see right, the now, need for course, a civil government prior to right. the fall.
Now, of course, the answer to that one, I think Aquinas would say, but what are you talking about when you say family? He would argue, I think, I don't know, I could be wrong because it's been a while since I dealt with this issue. And my mind works that if I don't need to deal with a topic, I shelve it. He would probably say, or I would be inclined to ask the question, well, aren't you then talking about the government of the family?
Well, we're talking about civil government. You know, I right. have a specific thing in mind that crosses family bounds and that establishes the order and the rules and justice for the entire community.
And that's actually helpful to distinguish that, because I think, myself included.
Yeah, well, you could argue that God has a government, but that's not what we're talking about.
Right, we're talking about the bearing of the sword and things like that.
Yeah, but even, yeah, the bearing of the sword, it puts the bite into the bark. You know, they say that we're going to do these things and you must abide. And if the citizens complain, that, you know, they say, well, we can punish you if you don't obey.
Right.
So that's what, but prior to the fall, you know, I didn't see a need for the civil government. That's my own opinion.
Well, we don't have instances of it, do we?
No, but that's an argument from silence.
True.
Okay. So there we go. And you and I agree that can be fleshed out in different ways, that the civil government exists to restrain evil, to promote justice. And
right.
that is a different concern than the church has.
Right. And by the way, that's a tall order by itself.
Oh, it's huge. Right. And how you do that, but then we get into the relation of the church to the state.
Right.
And I
right.
think they need to be kept separate and
right.
distinct, yet there's definitely a relation. You know, there are certain ways that the state must do its job. And I think abortion is a failure of the state to do its job. It's not promoting justice. It's not restraining
right.
evil. And somebody say, well, we're using our reason and we don't think that it's wrong to abort children. But then the church will say, no, you're not understanding God's commands. So there's an interesting and a very difficult relation between the two. How does the state do its job? You know,
well, clearly, we, in distinguishing between the role of the state and the church, that does not mean that the state has a right to act autonomously.
Exactly. But
right?
it also doesn't necessarily mean we have to have an establishmentarian view like many of the Scots did.
Right.
There are different ways to view this. And for those of you interested in history, the American Presbyterian Church is really a fascinating case study in church-state relations. Because when they, as Jeff alluded to, when the Puritans and Pilgrims came and set it up, there was much debate and disagreement over how to set up this colony. But when the United States government was formed, there was a lot of talk. Now the church was freed from the state and didn't have to submit to it calling assemblies and those sorts of things.
Right.
But also the state was free from the church in a sense, but the two could exist
right.
together and work.
Now, to be a little more accurate, on the federal level, there was not to be the establishment, but there actually was no requirement that the states disestablish the church. That it did happen eventually is true, as a matter of fact, of history. But there's no requirement in our federal founding documents that the states no longer have. In fact, Connecticut was the last state to not have an established church. And of course in Connecticut, I believe it was the Congregational Church, so it was on the federal level that there was to be no establishment of any particular
right.
religion.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a whole series of issues involving what we call federalism that enter into our proper interpretation of the Constitution. But clearly, as you say, Right early on, the General Assembly or the First Presbytery of the Presbyterian Church in the USA.
They modified the standards.
They modified the standards, and I think they did it. They were right to do so.
I do, too. I agree.
So and I guess at that point, we disagree with Doug Wilson.
Right. Well, he was very, very critical there, saying that, you know, in his opinion, as I understood it, we simply just modify the standards where we didn't like them. And he argues that to be truly reformed in Westminster confessional, we need to not go with those revisions and go back to the way they set it up at first.
Well, again, going back to, and this gets back to what I said earlier about, it was Israel unique. Once we recognize that Israel was unique, although there are things we can learn from it in our own government, but the fact of the matter is, I think Christendom was a failure to recognize that Israel was unique.
Mm.
There's more to it than that, of course, with the real politic of the medieval world and so on and so forth. But one could maybe on a simplistic level, look at Christendom, the merger of the church and the state. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know from our history that it was not quiet and peaceful. The Pope was battling with kings, and kings were battling with popes, and kings were battling with lesser nobility. So it wasn't all a peaceful settlement. But the whole idea of there having to be one religion across the territory, the uniform religious practice, I don't find to be a biblical notion. So and in this sense, we agree with Daryl Hart and probably, with Bill Dennison, right, on this point that the removal of the parts of the Westminster Confession which call for the state, the magistrate, to look after the peace and purity of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And to call synods and assemblies is
I think that's
a problem.
It is a problem.
I mean, it was a problem to allow them. It's not a problem to remove it. I'm in agreement with what the First Presbytery did.
Yes, me too. Absolutely. That's why we subscribe to that version of standards.
Yep.
Well, there was other discussion on the civil government and the role of Christians in government and politics and the military. And I thought that was interesting. And that led necessarily into a discussion of vocation. And that's a very important and distinct Reformed doctrine. And the question I asked was, what is the Christian's role in work? And then what is the goal in the Christian's vocation as it relates to this criteria? So how is the Reformed doctrine of vocation actually quite encouraging and liberating?
Well, to understand it, we have to go back to the Middle Ages and the notion that the only vocation
acceptable or the best,
the only acceptable or really great vocations were monasteries, clerical work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Vocations. And I suppose the one thing that's true about that viewpoint, if I may defend it, in a limited sense, was that if you are called to that life in terms of a minister, then you had better do it.
Which is interesting because the people that were writing the theology were the ones who were most likely called to that type of vocation.
But they weren't understanding
calling, that calling could be different for other people. They seemed to interpret the world according to their own life experience.
Exactly. They were making the mistake that what's true for me is true for everybody.
Yeah.
Because God has called me to this, therefore, it's better than what he's called you to. But the general idea of the Reformed, and we would say Protestant, because this was true in Lutheranism as well.
Yes, I should say that.
Mm-hmm. The idea of vocation was that God calls each one of us as his people to a particular vocation or calling, and it will vary. Some of us will be called to be ministers. Some of us will be called to be teachers in schools. Some of us will be called to be computer geeks.
Hey.
the point being is that we each have a calling.
Yes.
That God gives us, and that we are to ascertain that, and that each calling has legitimacy in God's providence, and it's not the legitimacy is not dependent upon what the church thinks about it.
No, and we often get this mixed up. I think the evangelical church, particularly the broader side of evangelicalism, I've found this kind of thinking in Campus Crusade for Christ, for instance. I was very much a part of that for several years through college, and then for a few years afterward, and my wife too. It's just general or incipient thought that if you're one that goes on a mission trip or if you're one that goes into and work for Campus Crusade, that that's somehow better. Now, it might be more, I don't know. I don't know if I'm willing to even say it's more directly related to the work that you guys, but what we've got here is the bottom line for the Reformed and for the Protestant doctrine of vocation is you can glorify God just as much sweeping floors as you can preaching from the pulpit.
Right.
There's different types of work, but if God has called you to sweep floors, you can glorify God doing that. You're supposed to be doing that.
Right.
And that's no less of a calling for you than for a minister who's called to deliver God's word, for instance. And that can be quite revolutionary to many people even today.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you, I really appreciate carpenters and mechanics and men and women who are good at what they do.
Yes.
Because I'm not good at many things, and I really appreciate people who, especially who are good at what I'm not good at, and mm-hmm. I just marvel the craftsman who puts who carves a furniture mm-hmm. or the mechanic or the architect or the civil engineer. I'm just fascinated by watching. I don't always understand everything I'm watching, but the point is that I realize that we can't all do the same thing, or else it would be a very, our culture would grind to a halt, among other things.
Yeah. Right? But it's important to know that God calls people to different things. We don't Absolutely. All have to shoehorn into some set model that
right.
is somehow objectively the better call or the better labor. And one, I think a phrase that encapsulates this really well, someone once asked Luther what he would do today if he knew Christ were returning tomorrow, and he said he would plant a tree. And
yes,
he was a gardener, and his point was, I'm glorifying God in what I'm doing so long as I'm doing it for his glory and I'm doing it well to the best of my ability. And that's really what's important, understanding that Protestant work ethic and that Protestant vocation can be quite liberating in our life.
Yes.
Lives.
And that was a radical reworking of the whole understanding of vocation.
Mm-hmm.
And it, in a sense, it would be a radical for the broad evangelical, I think, given what we've, what we've talked about already.
Now, moving on to our next section, we had a pretty fun discussion on education, another hot topic in Christian circles. How do we educate our children? Whose responsibility is it to educate children? That's the first question. Who do you think, Jeff?
Well, I forget now who said it. It may have been
I think they all did.
Nelson Klosterman, that it's the parents with the assistance of the church.
Well, I think his point was, generally speaking, for all of us people who agree with Kuyper, at least, he had this sphere sovereignty understanding, different
right.
areas of sovereignty for different governing bodies, that it would fall under the sovereignty of the family, particularly
yeah.
the father, the mother, the parents, to be responsible for educating their children. But then Dr. Klosterman brought up the interesting point of, well, what about in church? The church teaches, the church educates, the church holds the keys to the kingdom and is the steward of God's word, in a sense, for the church body. Now,
so
certainly the family needs to do that, but in that setting, it is the church's responsibility as well to educate.
Right, and so in that sense, then, the church offers God's word.
Yeah, and we always need to be, we're not permitted to teach false doctrine at home just because that's the sovereignty of the family.
Right.
That's not the
point.
And,
of course, the Kuyper's doctrine of sphere sovereignty never said that the different spheres didn't influence each other.
That's a good point, right?
Right. I mean, mm-hmm. that's really what I think Dr. Klosterman was getting after. Now, it's interesting that this is a perennial issue because I forget now when Robert Dabney, the Southern Presbyterian theologian, he wrote on this very topic that it had to do with the establishment of, I think, of a Department of Education or something to that effect in Virginia back before, during, or after the Civil War. He was arguing against it because he was arguing for the idea that the parents were responsible for educating.
That's a mind blowing idea to some. If you were a politician, I think Ron Paul did this a few years ago. He suggested they should get rid of the Department of Education.
Well,
and that
I've
just blows people's minds.
Right, I'm in favor of that, but also Machen would have been in favor of that
right.
because we know that back in the the 20s or 30s, right? He actually testified before Congress on an earlier attempt to establish a Department of Education. And he was opposed to it.
In other cases, people wanted to teach the Bible in public schools, and it might be surprising to some that Machen opposed that too.
Right, and it might be worthwhile saying, well, why was he? Well, because what happens when it's taught in school?
Mm.
Among other things, it becomes it's taught in a nebulous fashion,
and it's not taught by people qualified to teach it. It's not.
Right.
It's divorced from prayer and from the sacraments.
It becomes moralism.
It becomes an object of study, not the source of our life a thing
exactly.
of worship.
So whenever you are pushing for Bible, getting the Bible back into school and the prayer, remember that in our culture. Would you want the Quran forced upon your children? Would you want a mullah or an imam to be instructing your children?
I know.
That's not an impossibility.
I know, and I brought this up to my mother, who teaches music to grade schoolers, and they would sing, and it's a public school, but they would sing some Christmas songs that are, of course,
right.
It's Christmas. I mean, it would have Christian themes and things about Jesus in them and whatnot. And likewise, she would be very upset. I know her. She would be upset if, I went to school and had to sing, a Kwanzaa song or something. She wouldn't like that. And so I said, well, what's different? This is a public school. Why is it different you having the kids sing a song in a public school about Christ versus, a public school forcing people to read or study the Quran or memorize it, anything like that? It's a similar issue.
Right. The problem, the complex issue is, one, our nation it was built upon a Christian heritage. Whatever you think of that, that's actually a fact. Western culture is a mix, of course, of classical Greek and Roman, but also Christian. I would make the argument that you couldn't get, our heritage in America, the U.S., I should say, from a Muslim background.
But it's a different question to say, even if it was founded on certain principles, are they necessarily need to be taught promoted in the public school system? These are all difficult questions to get.
Well, through. Right. What I'm getting at is more or less, is there such a thing as a neutral setting?
Well, that leads us into the question, is public schooling a good idea at all? And so there are certainly other forms of schooling, and that was our question. Is there a preferred or even perhaps mandated form of education for Christians? We think about homeschooling, we think about private schooling, and we can also think about public schooling, which are all better than no schooling. But which is preferred? Is there a preferred? Or is it up to the family to decide?
I take the Dennis Johnson approach, which is that all three can be valid forms of mm-hmm. education,
mm-hmm.
Depending on the circumstances one is in. But, of course, if you go the public school route, be prepared, that you have to deal with the very kinds of things we've just been talking about, right?
Right, and, there are dangers sending your kids to private school. Even, there are bad kids in private school. You're going to get influenced from some of that too. I mean, that's not devoid of problems.
Right.
However, you're probably going to have to do less de-education or re-education, sending your student to a Christian school of some sort. But any three can be acceptable, I think, too, depending on the situation. And I went to public school, and I think I turned out okay. I had my own problems and influences in school, but I also realized that the public school I went to several years ago isn't even that same school is definitely not the same as it was
right.
when I went there. So
right, so you got to deal with the changes in the culture at large become reflected in the public schools. Well, they become reflected in every institution, but especially within the public school system.
Right, right. And so these are all matters of wisdom, but I thought the discussion on education was interesting.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Now, the next one up was fine arts. And the question, how should a Christian approach the arts? What is the Christian artist's task? These are tough. And this starts to explore the area of eschatology and what the theologian thinks about the enduring nature of the things of this world.
Right.
And it starts to expose your views on that when we start to ask a question like this.
I'm more sympathetic with Bill Dennison on this point because I don't know. Does the Bible really tell us that human cultural artifacts will be carried forward into the new heavens and the new earth, apart from our body, okay, which are not a human artifact, technically?
There seems to be a continuum between continuity and discontinuity.
Yeah, it's not a hard and fast distinction.
No, it's definitely not, because you have passages that talk about the earth being burned up, you know, and then really nothing passing through. But so what do we do when we talk about a really great painting, a really great piece of music? Will that endure? Will Beethoven endure into the new heavens and new earth?
Well, why can't we just say we don't know?
Well, I think that's the case. I don't think we have enough evidence to say dogmatically one way or the other, but I'm inclined to say that most likely there's more discontinuity than continuity.
Yes, that's when I agree with Bill Dennison, it's because I think we don't have, it's what we call an underdetermined question. And that's true, right? There are many things in this life, that questions that we have, that the Lord has not seen fit to answer in his word.
But, okay, that being said, we know that, you know, the work we do in this life that is for the kingdom and for God's glory, you know, all the hay, the wood, the stubble will burn up, but what remains will endure. So that leads to the question, is there a distinctively Christian type of music or painting or sculpture? Is there a Christian way to do these things, regardless of whether you think the Christian part of it will endure or not?
I think the answer is yes, but in a qualified sense.
Mm.
And this gets at the Vantillian, Kuyperian, as opposed to non-Vantillian, non-Kuyperian right. approach. I think that when we say that there's a Christian way of doing politics, or there's a Christian way of doing music or art, what I mean is that the Christian does it to the glory of God. So there's an intentional element, right?
Yes, yes, there's that.
And they seek to do it well.
Manner and matter. You could think about unbelievers doing the matter of good works when they give water to someone who's thirsty, but they don't do the manner of it. Likewise, we can have an artist who does the matter of good art, meaning that it's functional, it looks good, it's aesthetic, but it might not have been done in the manner to God's glory.
That's a very helpful distinction coming from the Westminster Standards that might clarify this discussion.
Now, I thought Doug Wilson brought a very interesting thing to the table on this question, because we think about, well, can an architect do a distinctively Christian building? Now, of course, we can talk about Christian symbols and all that stuff, but that the symbols and stuff aside. And Doug Wilson says, yes, all architects, if they're going to make a building that works, have to do it at least partially Christianly, because he says all God's truth, or all truth, is God's truth. And the natural world has been created and ordered by God. And for a building to be a building, there are certain things that necessarily must exist. You must abide by the rules of physics. You typically have to have a building that has a solid foundation, that has to be built with correct angles, with materials that hold together all these things. So you have to work within God's world using science, the science that God has established, and using physics and all of these things that go into building a building, geometry, everything. God is sovereign over all of this. So
and I think
he started to argue. I do too.
Right.
And he argued that a Christian building, at least as inconsistent as it might be, for a building to stand up, yes, you have to use Christian principles.
Well, see, that begs the question, then, what do we mean by Christian?
Exactly, exactly.
And this, in Doug's instance, I think what we're talking about then is what corresponds to reality.
And this is where he would differ with Daryl Hart, who is arguing for at least a natural sphere. Daryl's not going to say that these things aren't established by God, but he will tend to stress, maybe he wouldn't use this word, but a neutral area. He would say that science and rationality, right, these sorts of things are neutral, and the unbeliever can do them just as well as the believer.
Well, in the pure civic righteousness sense, that may be true. I mean, but but who denies that? I think all of us, except for maybe Daryl, have a view of common grace, which explains that.
Well, then the question I have, maybe to tie this up or to put an exclamation point at it, is a postmodern building that has a toilet on the wall unchristian?
Well,
according to Doug Wilson's understanding, because it's non-functional, it's not workable. It's simply just making a statement that this building is not rational.
Right. Well, in as much as rationality is God ordained and created and ordained, the answer is yes. It's non-Christian. it's foolish. Somebody might consider it art.
If you're making a statement, I wonder, maybe there's room for that in the Christian aesthetic. I don't
know. Well, yeah. But okay. At that point, then of course it's no longer in the realm of using it for what a toilet was made for.
Exactly. And the Christian understanding of aesthetics, the philosophy of beauty and whatnot is very complex. It's very fascinating, and I hope
all of us grant that we have absolute standards with regard to truth and morality, but the third, which is beauty, we're struggling with, aren't we?
Yeah,
I mean, we're taught that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but if beauty is grounded in God's person, then there is actually an objective standard. But how do we get at that?
Yeah, that's tough, isn't it?
Because most of the people that make that argument for an objective standard for beauty also tend to really like classical music.
Yep. And then they would argue for that in the worship service because they think it's objectively the best.
Right. And while I think the classical music is beautiful, I don't know.
I couldn't build a theological case for using exclusively classical music.
Right. I can't either. And that, I will admit up front that my wife is the classical music devotee. I've learned to develop a taste for it, but it's not the first type of music I'm drawn to.
Yeah, you like the Elvis.
Yeah, well, not in worship, brother, but,
Well, if there was a rockabilly church, I think Jeff might be candidating. Rockabilly Reformed Church, the RRC. There's a planter out there, a community that wants it. Jeff very well may be willing to plant that church for you. Well, with that, let's move to our last section, theological undercurrents, and we had three things under this heading: common grace, natural law, and eschatology. This is where it's at, and these are the engines, or the pistons on which this engine of Christ and culture run. So, common grace, how would you define it?
Common grace is God's allowance of sinners to continue to live. It creates the context in which redemption will unfold. The history of redemption will unfold. It also limits the outworking of sin, and it accounts for the cultural contributions of non-believers.
Yes,
now, by the very way that I've expressed that, I can see Daryl Hart wincing and reaching for my throat. I would imagine.
Hypothetical.
This is hypothetical.
All poetic language.
Yes. I mean, he's going, "Oh, Jeff, what is wrong with you, brother?"
Well, I remember him. He and Nelson Klosterman didn't think we needed the category of common grace.
Well, Nelson Klosterman didn't deny it. He simply said that it belongs in the category of providence. And I actually have no problem with that.
But that doesn't get me anything. And Daryl said, "Why do we need common grace when we have the doctrine of creation and providence?" And I could say, well, why do we need a category of soteriology when we have providence?
Well,
providence is too broad.
I'm
saying the category of providence is about as broad of a category as you could possibly get. And to me, that doesn't provide any cash value in theology, because the category of providence in this sphere when we use the category of common grace, I do believe it falls under providence, but I think common grace is much more specific in this sense of describing what we're talking about. What kind of providence are we talking
about?
Actually,
common grace, when you think about it, in the Vossian, Vantillian, Kuyperian understanding, actually crosses the line between providence and redemption.
Right, and I, as you said, I have a twofold view of common grace. The first, we could understand it to be the holding back or the abeyance of judgment, because given the fall, penalty should have been instituted immediately upon committing the crime, but God held it off for the sake of His church, so that salvation could continue. But the second aspect would be any blessing given to anybody falling short of salvation, in a sense, that would be a common grace. So the rain falling on the just and the unjust, both believers and unbelievers are recipients of common grace. Any good thing God gives, short of regeneration and salvation in Jesus Christ, is common grace. So there's those two aspects, I think, positive.
We're not unaware of the debates within the broad Reformed community about the existence of common grace.
We know.
For instance, Protestant Reformed Church has rejected the idea of common grace. Klaus Schilder in the Netherlands had a different take.
So David Engelsma, another that has rejected it. What's his name?
I believe he's Protestant Reformed, right?
Yes, yeah.
So, I mean, that's the view of the denomination. So we are aware of that, but it's the stand we take that there is such an animal.
I think it's a helpful category. I think it's very useful. But the second, natural law, another hot topic. We've done some work on this in some episodes. What is natural law, Jeffrey C. Waddington, and is it a legitimate Reformed idea?
Natural law, I believe, is the moral aspect of general revelation.
Okay.
It reflects God's holy character and is instantiated or embodied in the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments.
Yep.
It is involved with the covenant of works given to Adam in the garden, and is in some sense republished in the Mosaic administration. And therefore, there's an abiding aspect to it. There is some overlap, by the way, between the discussion of natural law and the discussion of common grace, in my opinion.
Mm.
It covers some of the same territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have, with Daryl and Klosterman, and you have this disagreement, and Doug Wilson, you have this disagreement because they're dealing with overlapping territory. The only reason natural law comes into conflict with common grace, in my opinion, is if you have a notion of natural law that undergirds neutrality.
Right. Exactly. That's a problem, because some people formulate the doctrine of natural law in an autonomous fashion, or allowing for autonomy.
Now, of course, the what should be said is the concept of natural law has become somewhat of a wax nose, but the truth of the matter is that every doctrine of the Christian faith has been abused and perverted, and if the rationale for avoiding natural law is that it has been abused, well, then we have to give up every doctrine in the Westminster Standards because they've been abused.
I think not to bring it back to this subject, as we always do, but the concept of union with Christ is sometimes maligned that way.
Yeah.
You look at someone like N.T. Wright, who has a doctrine of union with Christ, but it's bad because it doesn't have an understanding of imputation and a good doctrine of justification. So then people say, let's throw the whole idea out.
He has a bad doctrine of justification, so let's do away with justification.
Yeah, it's faulty reasoning.
So it seems to me that you can have a proper formulation of natural law, as going back to what I said earlier, natural law is the moral aspect of general revelation.
I think the way we do that is by also having a healthy understanding of the fall, and particularly its effects upon the mind, without the Spirit's work, and because we are sinners and fallen, particularly unbelievers, are going to interpret natural law incorrectly. At least they'd be inclined to.
Correct. Now, I'm interested, Daryl was challenging, I believe, Nelson Klosterman's reading of natural law, especially the comments about it in the Belgic.
Yes, confessor. Yeah, they went back and forth for a couple of rounds.
I'm not sure I'm convinced of Daryl's reading. Daryl seems to think, if I remember correctly, now correct me if I'm off here, that the limitation of the efficacy of natural law in the Belgic Confession, Daryl seems to take that to mean, well, unbelievers, the matter-manner distinction that we referred to earlier, the matter, they get really good, the manner, they don't. In other words, they don't glorify God in the way they ought to, but they're still able to understand natural law in a civic righteousness sense. Now, when I looked at that section of the Belgic Confession, and I don't remember what the number is right now, but when I looked at it, it looked to me like they were saying quite the opposite, that in fact, because sinners can't get the manner right, they can't get the matter right.
Mm.
That makes sense? In other words, on the whole. We all grant that sinners get some things right. In fact, they not only get some things right.
They get a lot of things right.
They do get a lot of things right, and they do a lot of things well.
Oh, of course.
Better than Christians. I think that's one of the problems that Daryl is wrestling with, is that because you're a Christian, you automatically do a better job at X.
Right.
Where I disagree with Daryl is I do think that the Christian has a leg up on epistemology.
Oh, yeah. And that's where he also went to Bill Dennison, who Bill Dennison argued that we need to have a self-conscious epistemology. And that was one of the things that Daryl started to really hone in on and criticize with.
Well, yeah, the problem with Daryl's criticism is it fails to wrestle with Romans 12, 1 and 2.
Mm, which is the renewing the mind.
Yes. Self-conscious epistemology is not the purview of philosophers. It's the purview of every Christian.
That's right. Yes, Jeff. These are good comments, good discussion here. Natural law. We're hoping to have David Van Drunen back on to discuss this very subject, and he's written much on it and has a lot of interesting thoughts. So hopefully in the future we'll have him back on Christ the Center to talk about natural law and some of his recent books. But our third and final category here under theological undercurrents is that of eschatology. How does culture fit into God's plan for his people through time? And then I ask protologically, typologically, and eschatologically. Protology, for us, that means the period between creation and the fall. Typology is the period between the fall and basically the consummation. And then eschatology is the period of consummation. Eschatology breaks forward because there's an overlap of the ages. But basically speaking, how does the idea of culture impact our view, or is impacted by our view of these different eras of redemptive history?
Well, culture, if we look at it as being whatever human beings think and do, right, and say, existed in the garden. It exists now and will exist in the new heavens and the new earth. The question is, what is the level of continuity, right?
Mm, right.
And I don't know that we can settle that here and now. I did want to say to Daryl, he criticized Bill Dennison for reducing culture to two. I think if I can, I'm going to try to defend Bill, but he may not agree with how I do it. Okay. So I don't want to suggest that this would be Bill's answer. Daryl criticized the idea of there only being two cultures with being naive. I think he misunderstood Bill. Bill is not denying that there's an American culture, a Canadian culture, a Mexican culture, a British culture. I'm sorry, not a British culture, an English, Welsh, Scotch, an Irish culture. the point is, there are various cultures, but that's not the use of the word culture that Bill was speaking of, right?
Yes.
He's speaking of this, you know, a regenerate versus an unregenerate culture. With regard to redemption, there are two kinds of people. as Van Til would say,
the most basic category right. for humanity.
And that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So that when we look at American culture, there's regenerate and there's unregenerate. Okay. We look at Irish culture or Nigerian culture or, you know, so on. Through every culture, there's going to be a divide. And I think Daryl just has, as he says, it's not hidden. He has a problem with the antithesis.
Yeah, right.
And of course, you know, the antithesis can be pressed in you know, to an extreme.
Like Kuiper did.
Right.
Right.
We do need to grant that, but Bill's point was merely is that the point of Genesis 3:15 and Augustine's The City of God
right.
is that there's the seed of the people and there's the seed of the serpent. Which are you?
Exactly. That's the most important question when we're talking about people, humanity, and culture.
Right. And as I understand Augustine, you're one or the other, not both. And of course, this gets into the whole two kingdoms doctrine, right?
Mm.
As well. Now it's true. I'm a Christian and an American citizen, but the Christian takes priority and precedence over the American citizen. As a Christian, God in His providence may have caused me to be born in Zimbabwe and not in the U.S., but in His providence, He's chosen for me to be born in the U.S.
That's right.
And as a Christian, I would be called to live where the Lord has placed me.
Exactly.
But everywhere where the Lord has placed me, there is a regenerate, unregenerate divide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you have a problem with that, you're going to have a problem, for instance, with the book of John.
Yeah.
Among others, but that would be one.
Well, that's a good point. And I think that was a conflict that was arriving from theological heritage. Bill Dennison being very well read and really loves and enjoys Van Til. Daryl is more in the Machen world and the old Princeton world that doesn't
right.
stress as much of the epistemological concerns of Cornelius Van Til.
Although
and so
we
you've got
we
some
ought,
differences there.
Right. But we ought to remember that Kuiper, Bovink, and Warfield were, not only brothers in Christ, but they were friends.
Oh, of course. And Bovink.
Now, they disagreed with each other on this very issue, right? This is one of those issues where Warfield couldn't wrap his mind around what Kuiper and Bovink were after with the antithesis. Although I think where the antithesis is misunderstood, and this gets at the whole idea of what does it mean to be a Christian artist. Christians and non-Christians, men both put on their pants one leg at a time, I think. Right?
you don't set your jump right into them both legs
well,
at once?
I could try, but I know what would happen if I did that.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, you're right.
So it could be pressed to a ridiculous extreme, and sometimes that there's a caricature. And for instance, you know, our good brother Carl Truman asks a question, you know, what's the difference between, you know, the Christian baker and the non-Christian baker's baking of cookies? And one answer could be the manner-matter distinction that we've already raised. And one of those would be, well, as a Christian who's obedient, and of course that's the qualifier, is not going to put poison in the cookies.
Mm.
The non-Christian left to his or her own autonomy, why wouldn't they or why couldn't they?
They wanted more business, so they would.
Right. I mean, in some ways, the whole the difference, say, between Daryl and our other three guests
yeah.
was really the debate over the effects of the noetic effects of sin.
And I guess, according to Doug Wilson, the Christian baker's dozen would be actually be 12. With a non-Christian who has an inconsistent mathematic, his dozen is 13. So...
Which creates a problem for me because I like the baker's dozen.
Yep. Well, I think with this, we're starting to disintegrate. But anyway, that was actually our last section. So I thought overall it was very interesting. It was a very interesting experiment for us as Reformed Forum to bring
yeah, yeah.
four guys on from different walks of life, yet somehow related to Reformed theology. I know we got a lot of flack for having Doug Wilson on, and I still stand by it, thinking it was a good idea to have him and have his input.
He was articulate.
He was very articulate. I thought it was very interesting to have him on. So publicly, I'd like to say thank you to Doug Wilson for joining us, and I stand by our decision to do that. Though we do have disagreements with him on other issues, and people can disagree with us on the propriety of doing such, but I stand by it, and I thank him publicly for that. And I thank all the other participants for joining us. I thought it was a great time, and we learned some things. If we ever do this again, we'll try to do it in a way that it isn't so trying, and in a way that kind of refreshes people's minds, because when we go on like this for 3 months, we start to forget what they said a long time ago. So anyway, with this roundup, we hope we covered the bases again. We gave and disclosed a little bit of where we come from on the subject, and we hope that this really sharpened the minds of our listeners. And if you have any comments, or suggestions, of course, you can email us at mail@reformedforum.org. You can also Twitter us @ReformedForum. And of course, I'd like to remind you that everything we do here is entirely listener-supported. We thank you for that. And we'd ask for you, if you're able and willing, to send us a donation. Now we have a P.O. Box. You can send it to P.O. Box 27422, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19118. We'd very much appreciate it. It helps us to cover all the costs, because there are a lot of equipment costs, bandwidth costs. We're pushing out a lot of episodes, a lot of data, and it costs money to deliver that to you. So if you've enjoyed what we've been doing, and you derive benefit from it, and if you're able, would you please prayerfully consider sending us a little bit of money to help us continue to deliver this content? And we want to, of course, thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to many, many more great episodes coming down the road. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you join us again on Christ the Center.